welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Wes Anderson's Costume Department, keeping thrift stores in business since 1996. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. This is part two of our discussion of Wes Anderson's career. If you want to hear part one, go to themacguffinmen.com and check out last week's podcast. Also, be sure to check back tomorrow when we'll have a new video podcast about repetitive trailers.
So moving on, we've got The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou in 2004.
Or as most people feel,
Yeah, no, exactly.
Or boo.
Zeese boo. You know, you gotta own the puns here, Jim.
All right. Do you like it, though?
I enjoy it as an entertaining film. Okay. I think any of the emotion in this movie, I think, falls entirely flat.
Yeah,
none of the resolution really means anything to me.
Yeah,
I feel like maybe it's because the movie just feel like drags or something, which I kind of do feel, but I can't think of anything specifically that I just wish didn't exist in it.
Yeah,
and very rarely do I make that complaint about movies, but it just doesn't resonate with me at all emotionally.
Yeah, when I watched all these movies again, as I said, Bottle Rocket probably went up the most, and this one probably went down the most.
Okay, but see, this is one that I've always sort of like disagreed with people our age on, and I feel like we've had this conversation before. I never liked this movie as much as anybody else I know. You know?
Yeah, I think the consensus on this movie is that Rushmore was really good. So let's give him a chance to do Royal Tenenbaums, and he knocked it out of the park. And then they said, "Okay, he's clearly great. Let's give him $50 million." And then this just totally fell flat, through and through. That's what my understanding is, the consensus on it.
Okay, that's the critical consensus for sure. Okay. But as far as like actual people, friends of ours are big fans of this movie. Like,
yeah.
One of my roommates really likes this movie a lot. And I've always sort of like stood on the side of. Yeah, I mean, I love parts of it.
Yeah.
I think, Bill Murray is so amazing in this movie, as is Jeff Goldblum. And Jeff Goldblum as well is great. It's a very entertaining movie and, again, stylistically really crazy. And like your point, relating it to the Royal Tenenbaums, I sort of see it as... obviously, my next example is on a much bigger scale, but it's sort of like Christopher Nolan made The Dark Knight, so now he can do whatever he wants. Here is Inception.
Yeah.
You know? And that's how Life Aquatic feels. And, you're getting these really extravagant sets, and the way that those sets are shot, basically the room is cut in half, and the camera's following someone throughout an entire ship, and they're really, really staggering, incredible shots. But... when it all comes down to like the emotional core of the actual movie, it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
Yeah. And yeah, I could watch this movie on mute, yeah. That's how good looking it is.
Yeah. I think visually this is one of my favorites for sure. I love all the yellows and stuff. I love the old classical look to it. Not that any Wes Anderson movie looks super modern.
Yeah,
at
exactly.
all.
As opposed to the modernist feel of Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah. No, I don't know. It's something about that. I love the animation stuff. The crayon seahorse or whatever it is.
Yep. No, that stuff's cool.
And the jaguar shark. All that stuff really works for me. And I don't know, it ties in with kind of a lot of themes of the movie where people are questioning, whether the documentaries are true, whether it's real, like what's real. And with those special effects, it kind of has that feeling where it looks like it's something real, but it so clearly must be fake. But I don't know enough about the technical ways to animate that kind of stuff.
No,
but
I'm sure it's all stop motion.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that exists somewhere, but not the way that it shows up in the movie.
Exactly.
And then, I think that's one thing that I do really like about the visuals. And I've said this on other podcasts we've done, but when visual elements or some other elements managed to tie in, the themes and the narrative really well, I think that adds to a kind of complete vision, and I think that always works really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing that I do really like about this movie is, that visual feature of it.
Yeah. And it's a very funny movie.
yeah.
I think when it's going for jokes, I think it's very, very funny. Like the heist when they're robbing Hennessy, who's Jeff Goldblum's yeah. character. That sequence is really funny. Like take everything or
and German Willem Dafoe. Why not?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. and I mean, Bill Murray is great. A good quote from my roommate that likes this movie, Nick. He said as we were watching it, he's like, man, Bill Murray is just the greatest phone-it-in actor of all time. And I think that's such an amazing,
it's
amazing
somehow it works. Yes. So well.
Exactly. Like, he meant it as entirely as a compliment, and I took it as such, and it's just like, that it perfectly describes his acting style. He phones it in all the time, but is so good at phoning it in, you know? And I think that's pretty amazing.
It transcends.
Yeah.
One thing I think that I did like about this a lot, I mean, I told you my opinion kind of dropped. I think... And you said you didn't like the ending that much at all. I think the reveal when you see the Jaguar shark and the Sigur Rós music,
yeah,
all that stuff, I think leaves a... I don't know. I like that part. I thought that left a good taste in my mouth. And I think that's kind of responsible for watching it again where I was like, oh, wait, it just left on a good note. And a lot of this is not very good.
Yeah. And I suppose... See, that's the thing. Watching it again, I thought Sigur Rós really didn't work.
Yeah?
And I like Sigur Rós. I like that song specifically. something about it it really didn't work. And it was only the second time I had seen it. I saw it once in theaters. And I always have sort of felt like part of the reason I didn't like the movie is because it wasn't Royal Tenenbaums 2. No, but
and it's not.
Yeah, it absolutely isn't. I mean, some of the same themes are present, but, you know, it's not the same movie by any means. I've always felt like that was why I was disappointed initially. But I feel like now rewatching it, I would have liked it if it was a good movie. And I just don't think it is. And I mean, we're not here to apologize for Wes Anderson's mistakes. This isn't a good movie, but we're not apologizing for, you know, the things that don't work, because there are things that do work. But, you know, having some good sequences doesn't make a good movie. A Cinderella story makes a smart point, but it's dumb. It's a shitty movie.
Yeah. Well, the ending to me, I think, is what really made me like it as much as I did the first time.
I've always liked the last shot of this movie. I think it's a very good last shot.
And I like the Jaguar shark, and I was reading about it, and they said it's one of the, like, the biggest puppets ever constructed for a movie, or biggest stop-motion puppets ever constructed for a movie.
Yeah, it's like 8 feet tall or something.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think that's cool, and it reminded me of Jaws a little bit, and like, you know, to make, you know, all the work they put into having the shark as the character and, you know, make it real and stuff like that. And just to go back, like, he certainly does not make modern looking movies at all.
No.
And I think that's one thing I do adore about most of his movies. Like I do like how they're kind of stuck in that time. And, you know, I think I just enjoy that, you know, it's this puppet that was made and controlled by hand cranks and people and stuff like that. And, you know, that's one thing that really, really works for me.
Yep. That's fair.
Anything else on Life Aquatic?
Yeah.
Did we say that?
Can
enough?
I say meh again?
All right. Now the pièce de résistance. The Darjeeling Limited.
Yeah.
You love it, right? Favorite movie all time?
Yeah, I like it.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
I've always liked this movie more than most people. But
guess so.
Yeah. I don't know. I think like a lot of Wes Anderson's later stuff, you know, not everything works, but the things that do work, I think work really well. I love the first 5 minutes of the movie. I also love the last 5 minutes of the movie.
And you love Hotel Chevalier.
I hate Hotel Chevalier.
Should hate Hotel
Chevalier. Yeah, okay. Because when I saw this movie in theaters, it played before, which is, it's an 11-minute short film that... 13,
whatever.
I wish it was 11.
Ugh.
That played before the movie. And it's just like, as I was watching it, I was like, this is so boring and bad.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched it again since I saw Darjeeling in theaters because, you know, the DVD I own of it gives me an option. You know, watch with Hotel Chevalier or don't.
You know?
I watched this movie 3 times this past week. Didn't choose Hotel Chevalier.
You know how much you hate Hotel Chevalier?
The opposite of how much a fat kid loves cake.
I was going to say, it shows Natalie Portman's bare ass, and you still can't watch it twice. Yeah, like, that's how excruciating poor it is. And
Natalie Portman shows her ass in exclusively bad movies, it seems like. That and Your Highness.
Your Highness. Yes. Oh, well, no one will see it in these movies.
Yeah, exactly. She's probably fully naked and no strings attached, but we'll never know.
No, I just, this movie, the first time I saw this, I saw it with Hotel Chevalier, And when, again, when I rewatched it, no Hotel Chevalier. But when I watched it the first...
No Hotel Chevalier?
I'm fucking...
You're on the puns today. Because the thing is, and you maybe you'll disagree, but Hotel Chevalier, outside of quality, seems very Wes Anderson to me.
Yeah, like, I remember it being very Wes Anderson.
Yeah, like not as much visually, but the way the characters speak to each other, all the dialogue and Jason Schwartzman, obviously, like so much of this is looks like Wes Anderson because it is, but it just sucks. Like it's everything about Wes Anderson I like except the things that I like, apparently. Yeah. Yeah. And that made me so worried for Darjeeling Limited because I kind of was like, oh, okay, so he's still himself, but he's himself sucks now.
Yeah, well, and like I said with Life Aquatic, like expecting Royal Tenenbaums 2, and then just kind of hating him because of that as a reaction to that. But I felt like after I watched Darjeeling Limited the first time, saw it in theaters and liked it, I was like, I don't know if I can trust my opinion on it because I've just liked it after immediately after watching Hotel Chevalier.
Yeah.
So it's just like...
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw someone review this and say that Wes Anderson should direct someone else's script to get out of his own head, and that he kind of... He kind of got in a rut by doing the same thing over and over. He kind of, you know, limits himself, and he tries to make every story kind of through the same Wes Anderson lens, and it doesn't work for everything. And, you know, doing someone else's script, seeing what, you know, what content requires, you know, certain treatment might make him better at doing his own stuff again. Do you put any stock into that or?
Well, I would like to see him direct a movie that he hasn't written, but he would just rewrite it anyway. You know, like, I think some particular, you see this with a lot of directors, and I think particularly with Wes Anderson, he's a control freak. He's a very laid back person, but he's definitely a control freak. And he's sort of like, this is a thing he knows he can execute properly, and he knows what is involved in it. And I mean, in each new movie, he does something kind of new. It's just thematically, the movies all sort of have very similar ideas behind them, you know,
right.
Like this is about, you know, fathers and brothers, you know, but, yeah. I mean, if he keeps making good movies, you know, if his movies start to suck, you know, like we said, The Life Aquatic is probably our least favorite collectively. But that doesn't make
after Hotel Chevalier.
Well, I'm not counting Hotel Chevalier because I don't know that I can classify Hotel Chevalier as a film. It's that bad. But like,
it might not be moving pictures.
I don't know if it is, you know, I've never seen that scientifically proven. But yeah, no, it's just like, you know, he hasn't made bad movies. He's made movies that are mediocre.
Yeah.
But it's just that mediocre for Wes Anderson is terrible for anybody else sometimes, you know, compared to what he has done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like the Darjeeling Limited. And I always feel like I was asking my neighbor this the other day when we were talking about Wes Anderson. And I was like, do you like the Darjeeling Limited? Because I feel like nobody does. And I always have. And I can't really explain why, other than something about the movie just works to me. It feels over, like, it's definitely a personal movie for these three writers, which are Wes Anderson, Jason Schwartzman, and Roman Coppola. And is sometimes way too over the top as far as visual metaphors, like, Adrian Brody running away from Bill Murray, to catch the train, which is essentially, you know, leaving your father behind. Yeah. They have to throw the baggage away at
all
the end of the
baggage.
Movie.
Yeah.
leaving the baggage behind, burying the hatchet, burying the feather. There's all these things that are just so obvious, that, you know, I just sort of tend to hate, but it's just sort of done in the very Wes Anderson-y style that it just works. And, I really like Owen Wilson in this movie. I like him in general, but, you know, I think he's good in this movie. And it's funny at times, and none of the drama really, you know, like, this movie won't ever make me cry, but I like it, you know, and visually it's awesome.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I mentioned not liking Adrian Brody leaving his dad, you know, his metaphorical Bill Murray dad behind. But I love that sequence. I love the first few minutes of this movie as far as like how it just comes in. Bill Murray's in the cab. He's like, he's going somewhere. He's very antsy. And that role didn't need to be played by Bill Murray at all.
No.
There's one kind of half moment that's very Bill Murray-esque, but everything else could have been done by any other actor in the universe. But I still appreciate that it's Bill. Anyways, but yeah, and I think that sequence is really great. And the way the song choice is wonderful, like the Kinks, This Time Tomorrow. And yeah, just enjoy the movie visually. The funeral sequences are really good, I think.
Yeah.
Like the way they go from the funeral in India flashback year to the funeral in New York, or, you know, or going to the funeral in New York. We never actually see the funeral and then come back to India. I think that's really cool. And visually how those shots transition, I think is really cool. And yeah, just stylistically, I think it's a great movie. And I think that and the acting can cover up for the things in the script that I don't like, and particularly the idea of going to another culture to find yourself, which I always hate. One of my
that never really works for me.
Wes Anderson movies tend to, and Wes Anderson movies have this weird sort of relationship with race anyway. And Darjeeling Limited is the one where it gets kind of the weirdest and, you know, bordering on, this is, I don't know.
But, condescending.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, Royal is this straight up kind of borderline racist character, yeah. You know?
I don't know how borderline he is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Calling Danny Glover Coltrane or like a big black bear or something. Yeah. Is that what he calls him?
You want to talk jive?
Although that scene is so funny.
Oh, it's funny, but
oh my God, it's so funny.
Yeah.
I'll talk some jive like you never heard. And then he just says like things like right on. Like it's unbelievable.
Not super offensive, but it's like, come on, you would never say that otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, with Darjeeling Limited, I think movies that are great visually usually get more of a pass from you than they do from me.
I've never denied that.
Yeah. And I probably do like this more than I probably it just gets muddied with how much I like his other movies, mm-hmm. I think is a big part of it for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, all the same stuff is here, except I don't like this as much.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I know. I feel like, again, they do go over the top of the personal stuff, like that Owen Wilson, who's the most paternal of the brothers. His character is named Francis, named after one of the fathers of the writers, you know, like, and also the, I guess, uncle of Jason Schwartzman.
Because they're related.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, I don't know. But I do like that one of the brothers is very paternal and a lot of good humor comes out of that. And it really feels like a movie that was like you like about Steve Zissou as far as, you know, feeling with the stop motion animation that they really, you know, that was like hand work, you know.
Yeah.
Darjeeling Limited really feels like a movie that was just sort of, they showed up and shot this, you know, and it's just sort of like there wasn't a lot of blocking. I remember Jason Schwartzman talking about that scene in the marketplace. They really, any sort of scene where they're just walking in the streets, they just didn't have time to do really setups or whatever, and they just had to go with it.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. And it really feels like that. Like before I heard Jason Schwartzman say that, I was like, you know, there's something that feels a little bit more realistic in this movie at times.
Right.
Clearly there are sequences that are very sketched out, like all the things on train cars and stuff like that.
Yeah. But, yeah. You have to.
Exactly. Well, you had so little room. They're shooting on an actual train car. It's the cinematographer in this movie, I can't even imagine like the tears he must have shed as Wes Anderson is explaining, like, okay, we're going to be on a train, so you can't hook a camera to anything. It's going to be about a meter deep, you know, like,
yeah.
Like he had to probably had to invent new wide angle lenses to get some of these shots to work. But
yeah. Want to move on to the Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Let's.
Yeah. Can you get a little closer to the mic? Nice.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay. Are you making kid noises because we're talking about a kid's movie?
I'm making fantastic noises.
I don't know if that's the word I would use.
Whatever. The movie's fantastic and not just because that word's in the title.
Yep. I remember, again, first time I saw this movie, saw it with the voice of our podcast. And I remember within a minute of the movie, like I looked over and she was looking right at me like, this is amazing. And I shared the exact sentiment. Like very quickly realized this is a good movie. After, you know, 88 minutes or however long it is, you realize this is a pretty good movie. Yeah. You know, it's so entertaining. It's so charming and very, very funny. You know, and again, thematically really follows along a lot of the same lines and has a kind of unlikable people as their lead characters. Yeah. But, you know, it works.
If it's a kids movie, it's one of my favorite kids movies of all time.
Yeah, I mean, the kids movies that I like a lot are movies like this and WALL-E that really toe the line, that were marketed towards kids, which probably makes them a kids movie.
But, yeah.
You know, like Moonrise Kingdom, you could probably end up calling it a kids movie somehow.
Yeah.
You know, but, although I guess they're really not marketing towards kids. It's just about kids. But yeah, no, I need, yeah.
But yeah, they steal some heavy, serious stuff.
Yeah.
And there's some slow parts that I can imagine a kid being bored through, but.
And like just the jokes in general. I feel like they really sort of relied on the style was sort of what the studio hoped would draw kids in, yeah. Like stop motion, which it didn't. you know, barely made back its budget, but.
It had like tie ins with McDonald's and stuff. Like it was. Yeah. I don't know. Just treated like a kid's movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because that's definitely
Happy
how it was marketed. Look, there's a, you know, you're calling it a kids movie because it was marketed towards kids.
Yeah.
As are very much the Pixar movies, but the people that like Pixar movies the most very often are adults.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the definition of kids movie is all in the marketing.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, funny. Very funny. I think Ash is the most interesting character in the movie. I really like Jason Schwartzman in this movie, I think, is great. He's an actor I don't always love. But I think, particularly in this movie, I think he's amazing.
Well, and it's such a good teen character for such a silly setting. Like,
yeah. I'm sorry, a good what character?
A teen character.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just it seemed like a normal teenage high school character, yeah. Like struggling with not being manly enough and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, not making the sports teams and stuff like that.
Yeah. And again, you may be able to tell that I listened to a long-form interview with Jason Schwartzman for research of this podcast, but he talks about he always sort of approached Ash, and this is a very actory thing to say, and Jason Schwartzman says a lot of these things, and it kind of annoys me, but he approached it like he wasn't even a little fox. He was just a person. And Jason Schwartzman says he can really identify with a lot of the things that Ash goes through, and that as a kid, he was always sort of, you know, at that age, he was... He liked girls, but the girls liked his friends, you know, like that type of thing, which is exactly the position that Ash is in.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and I suppose it added some authenticity to his performance, but just even the way he delivers lines, like, it's because I'm little, you know, like, so funny. And, yeah.
And, yeah, I see some Max Fisher there.
Like, yeah.
Tons of Max Fisher there.
Well, I mean, he's a precocious kid.
Yeah.
Know? And he's only 3 years younger than Max was.
Right? Yeah, and he's trying to impress everybody.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Also, the rules for stickball or whatever it is that they play, so funny.
Yeah.
Hotbox!
Hotbox.
Oh my god, it's amazing. It's like, I felt like that sequence, like when they're explaining the rules, was like how people that don't like sports think about sports.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, this is how football is.
Yeah,
you know?
That's how football works to people who don't watch football.
Yeah, I think that's so funny, and I feel like that was probably the idea. And so many little things throughout the movie as far as the writing, like the cuss. Like, are cuss, you cussing with me?
Cuss is hilarious.
It's so great. And how there's even, like, a piece of graffiti that says cuss.
Yeah,
like,
the cuss thing works very well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this is... We used to put this movie on at work a lot when I worked at a video store because it was, you know, family appropriate, but also very entertaining, which turned into, you wrote a bad song, PT, becoming like just something you could yell at anybody for making any mistake.
Yeah, that definitely became a thing between me and people that had actually seen this movie as well. Yeah.
Go see this movie, everybody.
Well, or just, you know, sit in the same chair you are currently sitting in and watch it. I feel like it's very easy to obtain.
Yes.
it's actually probably harder to go see it than to actually
you don't have to go
use
anywhere.
The internet or something.
Just watch it,
check Netflix, do whatever. Yeah, very entertaining movie, and the voice cast is very good. Do you know how they recorded the
outside and like in like forests and attics and stuff?
They tried to get as close to the situation in the script as possible, and Wes Anderson really plays dumb and like in a way that's just like, come on, there's no way you actually thought this. And that he said as they were, you know, planning to record this movie, he's like, well, I just figured they we just do it in situations as close to, you know, what they're actually experiencing, because that's how I thought most animated movies were done. I'm like, no, there's no way you ever thought that. I was 8 when I saw, like, a making of Toy Story with Tom Hanks in the studio alone. Like, come on.
Okay, so Finding Nemo, give Ellen DeGeneres the scuba mask. And nobody thought this ever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what a goofball. But, I think that's cool, and I feel like you can really, and there's one part where they had the best take of a specific moment. I don't remember what the moment was, but like a truck or an airplane flew by, and so they put a sound effect. They just covered that up in the movie, and Wes Anderson said it, like, he would never have thought to put that sound in, but that it makes it so much better.
Yeah, it made it even better.
And it really does feel like a movie that exists outside. As far as the sounds, and according to Jason Schwartzman, a lot of those sounds are actually real, and I buy that for sure.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
That seems like a weird sort of type of marketing to get people to like your movie more.
Shot outside.
Yeah. No, not shot.
Sorry, recorded outside.
Exactly.
Do you want to just talk about Wes Anderson in general?
If we have to.
If we have to.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson.
Yep.
One of the most consistent directors ever.
How do you mean?
Or how many movies he's made, how good they've been, not really having a lot of duds. I mean, 6 movies. Mm-hmm. You don't like Life Aquatic.
I think Life Aquatic is mediocre. I think...
That's not bad. That's his worst.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think Darjeeling is less than, you know, stellar, but good. And same with Royal Tenenbaums. Yeah. Yeah, I feel weird calling him consistent because his career feels a lot more... Like, whenever you think about Wes Anderson, you always... I always feel like he should have not a better movie than Rushmore, but another movie almost as good as Rushmore.
World which, Tenenbaums.
Exactly. I feel that's exactly what I think most people would say to that. But I don't agree with that anymore.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, no. What if Moonrise Kingdom is great?
Then I would love it. I would obviously have no problem with this. Okay. I want every movie I see to be great. So, yeah.
How much of an auteur is he?
Very much. Yes. Like, I know we disagreed.
10 auteur points out of 10.
Yeah, we disagreed on David Fincher on this point, but I think it's very difficult to disagree on Wes Anderson, if only because, you know, I mean, obviously he's an author of sorts in that he's co-written every one of his movies.
Yeah.
And that's not changing with Moonrise Kingdom. And yeah, whose movies now are like, who is making a movie in 2012 that is more easily, like, immediately identifiable than Wes Anderson?
Yeah, that's the thing. And
because
this is one of the things we debated over when we were trying to define auteur, for at least for our, you know,
our purposes.
Stipulative purposes is
because again, I would like to reiterate, I don't totally buy the auteur theory. I buy parts of it entirely, but to say that, you know, Wes Anderson is the only person that is involved with every single decision and Darjeeling Limited is insane.
Definitely. And
film is by committee, but
Well, and I think one thing that, you know, we would agree on for sure is that whether or not you know, when we have differing opinions of an auteur, that just his visual style is so present in all these movies.
And so obvious.
No, exactly. Like, it's up front, you know, in the first couple of minutes. Fantastic Mr. Fox, different just because it was his only...
Stop motion.
It was his only animated one. It was stop motion.
Yeah, and it's not even that it was animated. It's that it's stop motion really... He really had to rein things in as far as, like, the shots. Because, you know, he couldn't do his crazy pans as often as... you know, they're still kind of
zooms,
there. Yeah, exactly. Some of the things... Zooms are easier to do in stop motion, too, right? Because they were also shooting at a, you know, on DSLR, which is, like, a higher resolution than actual film. So, I mean, they could have just blown up a frame if they're doing a quick zoom.
Right.
As long as it never reaches a certain point. But... yeah, it's just like you really had to restrain because it took so much time to make the movie anyways. Like, if it was a very, very simple standalone, you know, every shot is exactly the same and the people just move, it would take so long. But yeah, so he really had to rein it in for Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is why I'm excited for Moonrise Kingdom. I feel like he's gonna
get back to it.
Yeah, he's like, well, it's been 5 years since I made a live action movie and he's got 5 years of new ideas, you know, that's great.
What else? So we kind of said we got the zooms and pans.
Yeah, okay. He's got a very like 70s, late 60s, you know, 70s aesthetic. Or I guess, you know, even earlier in the 60s. But a lot of zooms, a lot of pans.
And you normally hate zooms.
We've had this conversation. I hate zooms that feel out of place.
Okay.
There's always the potential for a zoom when you're watching a Wes Anderson movie. They never feel out of place. Whereas, a movie that just sort of has a zoom out of the blue. Like, there are a bunch of these in The Avengers, which is a movie we talked about a couple weeks ago, that, they're just clearly all CGI shots, and these zooms don't exist at any point in the movie. It was just sort of like, well, we're doing the CGI shot so we can do whatever we want with it. Put the zoom in real quick, like a quick zoom just to elevate how intense the scene is. And it really takes me out of the Avengers. And anytime that happens in a movie, be it drama or anything, it really, really hurts the movie, particularly since, you know, you're like an hour and 40 minutes into the Avengers before you see one of those things.
Yeah.
Whereas in Wes Anderson movies, the way his cameras move and the way the cameras are operated, there's always the potential. Always the potential for that. Whereas some movies don't feel like the zoom is right. You know?
Yeah.
The whole thing with any sort of visual aspect of a movie or editing is that whether or not it feels right. It's the same with writing, you know? It's like
same with most things in life.
Yeah, that's true. It's just like if you notice it, it's a problem. The thing with Wes Anderson movies is that he wants you to notice all the things he's doing.
Yeah. And we touched on it a little bit earlier, but kind of just how deliberate everything seems when it's set up. Like it seems like a photograph, like a well-staged photograph. Like the camera's not moving all over the place. I mean, they've got the zooms and pans we talked about, but we're not switching angles a lot. We kind of get things played out in one very clearly designed frame.
Yeah. No, I disagree a little bit with the camera movement, because he doesn't move his camera a lot, even aside from pans and tilts, particularly in Life Aquatic and Darjeeling Limited. I found this a lot. There are very, even, you know, those scenes, those shots where the camera moves a lot, they're still very, you know, clearly very well-organized shots. And things in, let's take the most basic Wes Anderson shot. You will typically have your characters facing the camera.
Yes.
Not looking at the camera, but they're sitting facing the camera.
Yep.
You will also have a lot going on in the background. Like, you'll have a very deep background, you know, with the people doing various tasks in the background, like the funeral scene in Darjeeling Limited, there's someone like washing clothes in the background on one side, someone just standing off in the far back background. Or even, you know, in Bottle Rocket, when Inez and Luke Wilson's character Anthony are just sitting on a porch, you know, Owen Wilson's character Dignan is like far, far away from that porch, just lighting off fireworks and stuff. Just stuff like that. There's always something happening in the background, and that thing that's happening in the background is always perfectly placed. Anytime you're in a room, that room always has so much stuff in it. Like, it's like,
there's pictures on the walls, like a crazy wallpaper.
Yeah. So many books everywhere. Just, you know, a plate, an ashtray, just so much clutter, just such a cluttered image, but everything feels like it's where it should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you don't have a very deep room that you're working with, you know, there'll still be so much to look at in every frame, even if there aren't people, physical people doing things behind it. But
yeah.
And yeah, that's a fairly standard Wes Anderson shot. Yeah.
All that.
But, you know, in camera movements, it's kind of crazy some of the things he pulls off in these movies. Like Darjeeling Limited, there's one sequence that's really amazing when Jason Schwartzman's character is checking his girlfriend's phone messages after the train has stopped and Adrian Brody and Owen Wilson are watching him. The camera is like in front of them and then goes over to the girl, Rita, that Jason Schwartzman had sex with earlier. And she's talking to her boyfriend. And then we see Jason Schwartzman walk in the background, and the camera goes back to Adrian Brody and Owen Wilson, and we see Jason Schwartzman come in the room. It's amazing. And just like, and that is not like one-time thing that happens in any of his movies. Like The Life Aquatic, there are so many of those things. Like we said, the ship cut in half where the camera's just craning around.
Which,
it's amazing.
Yeah, that boat scene feels sort of out of place. Like, it could be anywhere in that movie, but it's a great shot. Like, sequence is very enjoyable. Do you get kind of the feeling that a lot of these things remind you of a book? Like, we get, with Royal Tenenbaums, it starts with him checking out a book. Some other, like all the covers of his DVDs and stuff look like book illustrations and things like that. But do you get that like from other things too? This kind of novelistic, both visually and, you know, just the way it's structured and told.
Well, I mean, in a way, aren't all movies kind of?
Yeah, obviously.
But I mean, like, I agree with your point, and this is a very literary person. You know, like he used to write his own plays, from what I remember,
yep.
Or Jason Schwartzman did, maybe. Maybe I'm mixing them up. But yeah, Rushmore structured very much like a play. They don't hide that.
Yeah.
And Royal Tenenbaums is like a book. But yeah, I feel like those two movies specifically, and I think the art for all of his movies. I agree with your point generally.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I just, something about the structure too of most of them, like we get an introduction to the characters like very upfront. Like you don't get that in a lot of movies. Like they'll, I guess that's just Royal Tenenbaums and some other ones.
Yeah, I think it's just Royal Tenenbaums that you're thinking of there. Maybe Zisu.
Yeah, Zisu as well as the other one I was thinking. I don't know. They're just very upfront and like will describe a character and explain who they are. Fantastic Mr. Fox, obviously based on a book. You get a very book-like feeling
of
that
one
as well.
Yeah, they lay it out in Fantastic Mr. Fox as well. Don't
Yeah. And yeah, Bottle Rocket, definitely not. That doesn't really feel like that at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I feel that. And sometimes it's, you know, pretty obvious, like they show a book opening at the start and things like that. But I don't know, that's always, and I guess they're just very literarily minded people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he reads a lot, I guess. And I see the J.D. Salinger influence. I think that contributes to it.
Yeah.
Like Rushmore, it starts with him getting kicked out of prep school, which is the start of Catcher in the Rye. Royal Tenenbaums is based on a series of, you know, J.D. Salinger stuff. There's just kind of a literary influence that I feel injected into a lot of his stuff.
Yep.
You
would know more than I.
Okay.
Yeah. I read one Salinger book and didn't care for it.
Yeah, you read it too late, but it's okay. Yeah. Again, back with the auteur thing, we get similar actors. We get a lot of repeat appearances.
Yep.
Bill Murray.
Yeah. Bill Murray and Owen Wilson. Two people I like a lot in general.
Yes, that's okay if they repeat.
Yeah.
You get,
and Luke Wilson.
You get Luke a few times. Angelica Houston.
Andrew Wilson.
Oh, yeah, right. And
small roles. And Kumar Palana.
Yeah, Pagoda.
Yeah. And the tall, lanky guy who is the who runs the bookstore in Bottle Rocket is the teacher at the beginning of Rushmore. He's the doctor in Royal Tenenbaums.
Yes, he is.
I think that's the last time we see him. And yeah. Vikram and Darjeeling Limited is also in Life Aquatic.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just a lot of things like that.
And just thematically, I mean, there's a lot of things we get repeated.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
family relationships, father relationships, as well as sibling relationships. Death of family members and, you know, spouses, people close to you like that. And kind of mental health, like people.
Well, and it's sort of like kind of off the way the stories are told or the way the characters speak is sort of an off-kilter way, you know?
Yeah, so. For sure. But I mean, we get Bottle Rocket. He's checked in, like he's voluntarily at a mental health institution and clearly in Royal Tenenbaums.
And Dignan is clearly insane.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, and then the music. Let's talk about the music.
Okay.
Because that's something we get, you know, he has a very... he's very fond of his use of music, it seems.
He does it well.
The classic rock era, but we get some newer, more modern stuff sometimes, but we get a lot of folk stuff. And
pretty rarely, I think. And I think that part of what I don't like about the use of Sigur Rós in Life Aquatic is that it feels so out of place.
When's Nico, though?
Nico's, like, I feel like that record was made after she got kicked out of Velvet Underground.
Okay.
Yeah, like, that's, because she died in the 80s.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, classic rock, like a lot of 60s, 70s.
British Invasion.
Yeah, British Invasion music.
He likes the Kinks a lot.
One of his moves is going to be all Kinks, I thought.
Rushmore.
Rushmore is going to be all Kinks, right? But yeah, and something about the music. The music, the clothing, as you said, the way he shoots, it seems like a lot like he has some 60s, 70s influence. He seems stuck in the past, no?
Yeah. Yes.
And how we said he doesn't make very modern-looking movies, as much as we like his movies. And as you said, if you saw what Rushmore at this age in the 90s, like it is a new voice. Like, he is doing something new. It's not like he's just rehashing old ideas, yeah. But he does seem very stuck decades ago, as do many of his characters and how they dress and speak and things like that.
Same with the way he dresses.
That's true. Brown corduroy suits.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and I don't... It's weird, because he does definitely embrace the past, but, like, to embrace the past as much as I would perceive he does, like, you'd have to be kind of a dumb person. Like, it's just sort of, like, it's just, like, or at least extremely stunted and, like, I worry about you type of thing. Like, it's just, like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, he deals with so many characters who have a problem growing up.
Yeah, I know. No, I know. And yeah, it's just, yeah, maybe he just really won't be a very healthy person in 10 years or something. We'll be hearing a lot of stories about him in a mental institution or something. But and sort of like, I guess the only way I could really think about it was that I see a lot of parallels in a way, you know, in very specific ways to the career of David Fincher. We've talked about it at length. Our last O'Tour podcast was about Fincher. And the way they use camera movements is very similar in that they both love camera movements. Yeah. The difference between the way they use camera movements and the way they use filmmaking technology in general, Fincher, very much a modernist. Anderson, very much, like you said, stuck in the past. Whereas Fincher will do all of these takes, like, you know, so many takes to make sure the camera movement is done perfectly. Like, the frame is exactly what he wants. Whereas Wes Anderson's, and they use a lot of the same movements, like quick tilts and quick pans and stuff like that, and very elaborate, like, tracking shots with pans and tilts involved. And just sort of, like, where Fincher needs to get it right, I feel like Wes Anderson's like, okay, I like these bumps. Because, you know, these camera movements aren't smooth. Like, they aren't, I mean, they aren't perfectly smooth. They're not Fincher perfect, but, you know, nobody does that.
Yeah.
Except for Fincher. And, you know, Fincher has embraced digital filmmaking, whereas if you told me Moonrise Kingdom was going to be shot digitally, I'd vomit out of confusion, you know, which is not the type of vomit you do very often. You know?
No, that's a rare one.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, and it's just, and just sort of the way Fincher's movies tend to be about very modern things as to when they're released. And whereas Wes Anderson's always sort of feel like they were released at the same year, you know?
Yeah.
Like, collectively, like you know, every movie he will ever make was released in 1970, but they're just, you know, dispersing them out like bootlegs or something that have just been stored in time.
And, like, no one uses a cell phone. Like, nothing seems remotely modern.
Although you do get a couple IMAX in Royal Tenenbaums in Chaz's office.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There you go. Which was, like, you know, the most modern technology. Yeah. But it's like you said, just sort of a very heightened reality.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they don't... These movies don't shy away from showing us dates, really, because, you know, Royal Tenenbaums ends with Royal's tombstone, which says 2001, which is the year the movie was made. You know, Rushmore, there's a tombstone of Max's mother at some point. She died, like, it's said she's died 7 years before or something like that.
Yeah, and in Rushmore, though, we go through all the seasons in what it's supposed to be a couple
weeks. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So,
yeah. What's the most Wes Anderson-y movie?
Rushmore.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's those things you said, although I guess maybe the most Wes Anderson movie would sort of have to be the ones where the characters grow up the least, maybe.
Yeah, I can see that.
So maybe, I don't know, I suppose you can make an argument Rushmore. For anything but Rushmore, yeah. I guess. I feel like Rushmore is the movie where the characters grow up the most, but it's not a wide margin.
Right.
Yeah. Except maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox, you know.
Yeah, they
but they don't grow up too much,
yeah. Yeah, they kind of just get away from their problems exactly. instead of dealing with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
Well, another thing that, like, bothers me about Wes Anderson, and again, like, for a guy whose films I like as much as I do, is, like, I kind of dislike him a lot, is that he's a very self-indulgent filmmaker, I think, and yes. a very self-indulgent person, and I think... You can really hear that on commentary tracks for his movies, where he talks about all of the paintings and nothing to do with the movie. Like, just like, oh, this little piece that's in the background there, I got this from that. And, like, he's very obsessed with the image, and I think that's why some of his movies really visually fall flat in the writing, whereas everything technical is great.
He's just so focused on the visuals.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I'd love to see him try and write something again with Owen Wilson, because... As far as I know, Owen Wilson hasn't written anything that, you know, has been for public consumption since 2001. And I mean, Noah Baumbach in general, I don't like him as a writer. Like he has such like this dark sort of way of making movies and such. And Roman Coppola, he hasn't done much outside of co-writing these Wes Anderson movies, but I mean, he directed a lot of the early Strokes videos, but, other than that, you know, I don't know. I feel like, you know, his writing has taken a downturn, even though I don't love the writing of Royal Tenenbaums as much.
Yeah.
They did write Rushmore together. So I would love to see them try something again.
Lifetime pass.
Yeah, exactly. And just, I mean, I'm all for Owen Wilson having a great successful career, which he has, but.
Gilbert Taylor.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. But yeah, no, I would like to see them try and work together. Or, you know, we mentioned this earlier and we just sort of pushed it off because we both know it'll probably never happen. The idea of Wes Anderson directing a movie he doesn't co-write.
Yeah.
Which I think would be really, really interesting and probably healthy for Wes Anderson, maybe. No, I mean, we're putting thoughts on a person we've never met and never will meet. But yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have such a weird conflicted opinion about all of
clearly
it, about him.
You're struggling
exactly that. I've been we delayed recording this almost a full week and I'm still perplexed about this guy. Like, he's unknowable, and I feel like as much personal stuff is in these movies, like, clearly I feel like I don't know Wes Anderson at all, whereas I feel like after talking about David Fincher or Darren Aronofsky for as much as we did, I feel like I know their movies.
Yeah.
And I know them as people. Same with John Hughes, even, who we did a less extensive look at.
Yeah.
And I guess it all ties back to the way I think about Rushmore, which, again, is a movie I've seen probably 25 times. I always sort of, like, when I'm thinking about Rushmore, I can never really, like, piece together the moments where these things happen in my mind. Like, this is a movie that I should know better than most other movies that aren't Ghostbusters. And it's just like, it always sort of just feels unknowable. And I think that's sort of how Wes Anderson movies feel in general. It's like, some of them will make you feel something, you know, like there's some sort of emotion there. You don't totally know why you're feeling it because you recognize all of the flaws in his movies. And it's just sort of like, well, I love that and I want more of it, but I don't necessarily know why.
Yeah,
you know, like,
just can't put your finger on it.
And it's totally perplexing. And him in interviews, same thing. Yeah. Like I said, like, there's no way he actually thinks we would believe he didn't know how animated movies were recorded. You know, like, come on. It's just perplexing.
And he looks a little bit like Michael Bay.
Yeah, I know. I see that.
But no one's allowed to say it.
I see that entirely. And him and Jason Schwartzman sound shockingly alike also.
Okay.
Have you ever noticed that?
I haven't listened to that much of Wes Anderson talk.
Wow, they sound very similar. So Moonrise Kingdom is Wes Anderson's next movie. It's coming out on the 25th, I think. We're gonna do.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm interested to see. I only watched the trailer once, and I remember, you know, Bruce Willis being there, so that's awesome. And shirtless Bill Murray, if I remember correctly, always a plus.
There's a lot of shirtless Bill Murray.
Good. The more the merrier. When Moonrise Kingdom comes out at some point, we'll talk about it and we'll either tack it on the beginning of the or the ending of a later podcast, or we'll just do a short podcast about it and just throw it out there in the middle of the week. Just keep the people satisfied. Thank you for listening to MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We'll have another video podcast coming out tomorrow about repetitive use of the Inception music and trailers. Follow us on Twitter as well at the MacGuffin Men. And thank you for listening.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men.